Hi, this is Kim Stanley Robinson, and you're listening to Sci-Fi Dimensions.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Dimensions.
Okay, this is the Sci-Fi Dimensions podcast. My name is John Snyder. This is show number 8, featuring an interview with John C. Wright, author of Null A Continuum, a sequel to A.E. Van Vogt's classic novel, The World of Null A. My guest this time is John C. Wright. He published his first novel, The Golden Age, in 2002 to critical acclaim, and he shows no signs of slowing down. His works include The Golden Age Trilogy, which consists of The Golden Age, The Phoenix Exultant, and The Golden Transcendence, The War of the Dreaming Duology, which includes Last Guardian of Everness and Mists of Everness, and the Chaos Chronicles trilogy, which consists of Orphans of Chaos, Fugitives of Chaos, and Titans of Chaos. Wright also has a number of short stories and essays to his credit. Wright's latest book is called Null A Continuum, which is a sequel to the trilogy of books written by the late, legendary A.E. Van Vogt. Van Vogt, who died in the year 2000, was one of the masters of modern science fiction. He wrote a number of influential works. Probably the most notable of these is Slan, a story involving post-human evolution and attempted genocide. Van Vogt's other most notable work is The World of Null A, which was originally serialized in 1945 in Astounding Stories, and was the first science fiction novel to be published in hardcover after World War II. A sequel, The Pawns of Null A, also called The Players of Null A, was serialized in 1948 and published in novel form in 1956. In 1985, very late in Van Vogt's career, he published a third volume called Null A 3. For good or bad, Van Vogt is largely overlooked by new readers, but it would be hard to exaggerate the impact that books like Slan and The World of Null A have had on science fiction writers in the mid to late 20th century. Now, we could spend an entire episode sorting through the incredibly complex epic of Null A, but I'll give you just a primer. First of all, what is Null A? Well, it's shorthand for the phrase non-Aristotelian logic. As it turns out, Van Vogt based Null A on a real-life discipline called general semantics, developed by Alfred Korzybski in the mid-20th century. Basically, general semantics rejects what it sees as the black-and-white logic originally proposed by Aristotle. General semantics emphasizes that our perceptions of reality are at best models, and that some models work better than others. Also, general semantics cautions against the limitations of language in describing reality. These ideas are succinctly expressed in the phrase, "The map is not the territory, the word is not the thing defined." As I mentioned before, Van Vogt's Null A trilogy is incredibly complicated. Some might say too complicated. Nonetheless, the first book, The World of Null A, begins the story of Gilbert Gossain, who thinks he's a simple farmer whose wife has recently died. To his dismay, he soon discovers that everything he believes about himself is a lie, and so he sets out, armed with the mental discipline of general semantics, or Null A, to discover the truth. By the end of the book, Gossain reveals an alien conspiracy to take over Earth. He also learns that he is essentially immortal. If he dies, his mind is automatically transferred to a new body. Gossain doesn't know who initiated this incredible system or why. He also finds out that he has an amazing secondary brain, an organ that gives him limited telepathic and telekinetic abilities. I don't want to give away too much about what happens in the second and third books in the trilogy. Suffice it to say that Gossain finds himself in ever more cosmic circumstances, and in the end still doesn't uncover the whole truth behind the how and why of his existence. Neither the Players of Null A nor Null A 3 are in print anymore, but you can usually find them at places like Amazon.com or eBay. I've written reviews of all three of Van Vogt's Null A books, and you can find those reviews at SciFiDimensions.com. Which brings us back to our guest, John C. Wright. He has taken upon himself the ambitious task of writing a fourth book in the Null A series, called Null A Continuum. Now, I've always found Van Vogt a little hard to read. His style is dated, and his science is a little too goofy for my taste. Nonetheless, Van Vogt can spin an exciting yarn, and it would be hard for another writer to copy both his style and his fast-paced storytelling. Nonetheless, John C. Wright has pulled it off. Null A Continuum reads like a book that Van Vogt himself might have written. To make a long story short, if you like A.E. Van Vogt, you'll love Null A Continuum. In addition to his success as a writer, Wright is also notable for his transformation through a series of visions from atheism to Christianity, and most recently to Roman Catholicism. We discuss the possible effect of this transformation toward the end of this interview. So without any further ado, here's our conversation. Well, John, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
My pleasure.
Well, tell me how you got involved with this project. The World of Null A is obviously the famous classic of modern science fiction by A.E. Van Vogt.
Well, the story has two beginnings. One is when I was 12 years old, when I read The World of Null A by A.E. Van Vogt, and fell in love with this book. And it was one of the first science fiction books I read. And I read it during the golden age of science fiction, which, as we both know, is when you're 12.
That's right.
The book had a profound impact on me, profound effect on me, and it was a typical pulp adventure novel, but with a twist that there was some philosophy, something called general semantics, that A.E. Van Vogt very cleverly wove into his sort of action thriller plot. The book impressed me because the hero of the book, Gilbert Gozian, does not prevail because necessarily he is stronger or meaner or faster. Or even smarter than his opponents, but because he's more sane, because his mind can more quickly and easily adapt to the confusing circumstances around him. And the circumstances around him are Hitchcockian. He's confronted with puzzles. He is an amnesiac. He doesn't know who he is or who his friends are, who his foes are. So he has to adapt very quickly to the confusing circumstances he finds himself in. Now, I grew up, became a science fiction writer after a career as a failed lawyer and as a mediocre newspaper man, and saw in a trade magazine that Lydia Van Vogt was contemplating having a sequel done for Slan, the Slan Hunter sequel that was recently came out from Kevin J. Anderson.
Right.
So when I saw that notice, I thought, well, heck, if Mr. Anderson could do it, I can do it. Because, of course, young and confident and think I can write this stuff. So I looked up on the internet the name of the Van Vogt agent, which was Dan Hooker. I merely gave him a phone call, wrote him a letter. To my extremely pleasant surprise, he phoned me back. And at that time, I had 4 books published, so Mr. Hooker knew I was not just chopped liver. I wasn't just some nobody, some interloper.
Right.
But he also knew I was not so famous that doing a collaborative project like this would not be worth my time. He at first was reluctant. He said that there weren't that many publishers who were interested in maintaining the legacy of Van Vogt. There weren't that many publishers he would really trust to edit it correctly. In fact, he said there's only one publisher in New York who he would really trust with such a project, and he said the name of the editor was David Hartwell. Well, it was an infinite pleasure that I was able to tell him that David Hartwell was, in fact, my editor.
Right.
With whom I have a very good working relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I then wrote a proposal, first 3 chapters and an outline, and I sent the proposal both to Mr. Hooker and to Mr. Hartwell, and they communicated with each other, and eventually came to an agreement. And then, I hate to say, poor Mr. Hooker passed away, and Alistair Grayson, Mr. Grayson, his partner, his superior in the firm, came online and took his place. The manuscript that I wrote was shown to the widow, Lydia Van Vogt, who I spoke with on the phone more than once. And she is maybe the nicest person on the planet. I was very pleased to speak with her. She was very charming, very supportive, and she loved the manuscript. She thought that I had perfectly captured her husband's style, the tone, and she was pleased with the surprise ending that I had put in the end. So she was very enthused about the project. But there were some legal questions that had to be negotiated rather delicately between Tor Books and the agency and Van Vogt's agency. So while Lydia Van Vogt and I were both, you know, gung ho about the project, it dragged during the negotiations, and it was partly because what I had done was not something Tor had done before. Usually, if you write a book in someone else's background, if you write a Dune book, or if you write a book that is a sequel to Rendezvous with Rama, or something like that, it's work for hire. You don't retain a copyright or anything else. So what I had done was actually kind of new, because I hadn't been working on any notes that Mr. Van Vogt left, unlike Kevin J. Anderson, who was working from an outline that Van Vogt completed for a Slam sequel before he'd passed away.
Right.
A man named Edmund Wilson, who runs a Van Vogt website. Oh, I hope I did not mispronounce his name or get it wrong. I fear I might have. helped me with some of the research, and through his good graces, I was able to get my hands on the original magazine version that appeared in the 40s, which was somewhat edited from the paperback version that was later published. And World of Noé, I don't know if you know this, but it was the first hardback science fiction book published after World War II, after the paper shortages caused by the war were over. So I was able to see some of the more original manuscripts and mine them for certain ideas. And I was very pleased with myself, and perhaps I shouldn't brag, when there was an implication of one of Mr. Van Vogt's little plot twists that he had written out in the magazine version that did not appear in the novel version that I had read as a child.
Is that right?
So he sort of confirmed my thoughts on a certain implication, a certain plot twist that he had done. And of all books I have written, this one was the most pleasure to write. I don't know if that's because I was working with someone else's material. I don't know why. It was just easier and, these are my favorite characters, and they're my favorite childhood characters, and I, of all people, got to decide, you know, what their ultimate fate was and who Gilbert Gozane actually is.
You mentioned that you went back and read the original version of The World of Nolé, and for myself, in preparing to read your book, Nolé Continuum, I decided I would go back and read all of the Nolé books, and unfortunately, Players of Null A, which was the second volume,
yeah,
and Null A 3, which is obviously the third volume, have been out of print for a long, long time. I'm not sure how long, but I found them on eBay. I actually found old mass market paperback. Did that cause any concern for you in terms of people being able to pick this book up and kind of continue with the story?
Well, it certainly does concern me that Van Vogt is not as well known and has not been in print to the degree that I think he should be. Back in his day, he was a bigger writer, more well known than Asimov or even Heinlein. And nowadays, mm-hmm, hardly anyone has heard of him. And as you have said, his some of his books are out of print. As for whether the readers would be able to find it or not, that wasn't in the forefront of my mind. I did try helpfully to provide a short summary of the first two books in the introduction section of my novel. Naturally, I would prefer, you know, that fans of Van Vogt, that people who are familiar with the first two books, read my book, because there's certain little clevernesses that I put in that reference the original books, and certain plot twists that some readers might not understand unless they know what happened in the original book. But I did try to write it so it's not absolutely necessary to have read those books. So the long and the short of the answer is, yes, it does concern me that they're out of print, and it does worry me that some people might not get the book or might not enjoy the book if they haven't read Van Vogt.
Right. Yeah, I thought your summaries were pretty good. I do think for somebody to really get the full impact of what you've written, if they're fresh on what Van Vogt himself had written, it certainly is for the best.
Did you manage to get a copy of the Players book and read it before you?
I did. Yeah, I found both Players of Nolé and Nolé 3 on eBay. So that was my fallback position. When in doubt, eBay. You can find anything on eBay. Well, we've
Players,
been
in my opinion is actually the better book of the two. I like it more than the World of Nella, even though I do like both of them.
You know, I agree with you. I actually wrote that in my review of Players of Nella, that I thought it was a little better. And part of the reason I thought it was better, which actually leads me to the next thing I wanted to ask you, is that, and you do this in Nella Continuum, the beginning of every chapter has a little epigram that explains some aspect of the philosophy of Nella.
Yeah.
Because when I first read The World of Nella, I mean, I grasped that there was some sort of method of thinking or philosophy that Gilbert Gossain was using, but I never quite fully understood what was going on. But in The Players of Nella, I think Van Vogt did a good job of peppering it with some information. But can you tell us, what is Nella and what's it all about?
Nella is an abbreviation for a certain philosophy called non-Aristotelian philosophy. Non-Aristotelian philosophy is the brainchild of a man named Ibis Korzybinski, and I believe I'm mispronouncing that name. I don't know quite how to pronounce it. he was a theorist who supposed that the content of the human mind, that the way our nervous system operates, is determined entirely by semantics, by the words we use and by the concepts we use to manipulate the pictures we make in our head of reality. And his concern was that if the pictures or the models we make in our head of reality are insufficiently accurate, that it would cause disturbances in the organism. It would cause people to have neurotic, insane, or unsane reactions to things. They would overreact. They would react emotionally when they should be reasonable. They would be caught up in mass movements that were disconnected from the real world. And he lived in the 30s and 40s when it's no exaggeration to say that mass insanity affected whole peoples, whole nations were swept up in hysterical anger and madness during World War II and the years before World War II. And so his belief was that the inaccuracies of human thinking are caused by insufficient precision in the way we use our words and in the way we not just use our words, but the way we habitualize or internalize the behaviors that our philosophy is based on. And the reason why he insisted that we should use a non-Aristotelian philosophy is he thought the world was multivalued. Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotle, is two-valued, either A or not A, black or white, yes or no. He thought that reality was more of a continuum, that there was more than one possibility between yes and no. There were shades of gray. And so he wanted to insist that we attempt to use a multi-valued logic system, not just with our rational calculating minds, but so habituated into our subconscious minds that it became a matter of automatic reflex, what he called integration between the higher and the lower faculties in the human nervous system. That was his theory. And what Van Vogt did is kind of popularize this or pulpize it by having his hero be from some far future world where the daydreams of Mr. Korzybinski had been fully realized and humanity had finally achieved a maturity and a sanity that we poor people living in the 20th and now the 21st century don't comprehend.
Did you read up a lot on Alfred Korzybski while you were preparing for this book?
I hope I will not lose any readers if I say not a single syllable.
No. Really?
I read Van Vogt, and I was familiar with his description of it. And I'm sure there's a lot more to it. I'm sure there's a professor in Hayakawa in the University of California who's also trying to popularize some of the notions that the map is not the territory, the word is not the thing it represents. But no, it's not something I did any research on.
Interesting. You know, another book that I was reminded of when I first read The World of Nella was Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, in the sense that both books are sort of the explication of the author's particular philosophy, sort of a dramatized versions of their philosophies. Of course, it was objectivism in Atlas Shrugged and general semantics in Nella.
Well, that is an interesting point. Because I'm not sure how much Van Vogt himself believed in gentle semantics. I know that he used the idea in some of his stories, and I know that he was always interested in the potentialities of the human nervous system. And I know
Right.
that he was always interested in things like Dianetics or other educational systems or religious or philosophical systems that might give mankind a kind of a leg up into the next plateau of human thinking and evolution. But I don't know, I'm not familiar with him himself. I mean, I know that Ayn Rand was completely serious about her philosophy. It wasn't something she invented for the novel.
Right.
Her novel was merely a method she was using to try and spread her, not just her philosophy, but her vision of how human beings should behave, her heroic view of mankind. Van Vogt is not as passionate as Ayn Rand. I don't know how much of the book is actually himself and how much is merely his arterial voice. Writers are funny people. It's hard to tell what they're really thinking.
No, yeah, but nonetheless, it was interesting to me some of the similarities. You know, for example, in Atlas Shrugged, the right-thinking people voluntarily remove themselves from the world and let the world sort of run without them. And in The World of Nalé, all the right-thinking people are sort of culled out and sent to Venus, where they live in this sort of libertarian utopia.
I don't know if it's libertarian as much as anarchistic.
That's a good way to describe it.
The Venusians don't seem to have any laws at all, except for the sanity created by their philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have detectives. There were some similarities, I think. If nothing else, they're both books that placed a heavy emphasis on philosophy. I can't think of another novel that is actually trying to portray or use a philosophy as the linchpin or the gadget that is the plot driver, aside from those two.
Tell me a little bit more about how you prepared to write this book. Well, one thing I would say about Van Vogt, particularly the Nalé books, is that he makes things happen fast and often. Things get really complicated.
Listen to your opinion. Do you think that I successfully did the same thing in my book?
Yes. In fact, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, we can talk about maybe this all at one time, is you mentioned Kevin Anderson wrote Slan Hunter, which was the sequel to Van Vogt's Slan.
Right.
And I think one of the things that Kevin took a lot of heat about was that he wrote that book as a I don't want to say he wrote it as a Kevin Anderson book, but he wrote it with his style.
Right.
So it was not the same experience as reading Slan, because I think the older writers, people like Van Vogt and Heinlein, one of the things that makes their writing interesting today is it has become sort of sepia-toned. There's a certain charm to the style. There's a certain charm to the context. And Van Vogt definitely reads that way now especially to people who have not read him before. So I think to your credit, you definitely copied not only his writing style, but his storytelling style, if you see the distinction.
Yes.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about that. How did you go about – and I just finished reading Nalé Continuum, and I'm wondering, did you have like a flow chart for this thing? Because it's very complex.
No. Here's what I did. When I first got the permission from Dan Hooker to submit an outline,
mm-hmm.
I sat down at my computer and immediately wrote the entire outline from start to finish, without pausing to eat, with almost no forethought and no calculation on my part. And if the book reads like it's slightly wild and slightly dreamlike, that's deliberate on the part of your humble author, because I was trying to impersonate Van Vogt's style. I attempted to about every chapter or every half chapter to have some plot twist or sudden reversal.
Mm-hmm.
And that enforced a discipline on how the plot could possibly work, because if nothing can be linear in the plot, a certain type of logic takes over, call it any logical logic, if you will, where no one can actually turn out to be who they seem to be at first, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That in its own way made it kind of easy to write. This book, I'm going to sound like I'm bragging, but it's one of the unfortunate drawbacks of talking to writers or artists, is that they're prone to ego, and I apologize for that. But this was written in a burst of pure Van Vogt-like inspiration, with almost no calculation on my part, with almost no preparation aside from rereading the three books. And but you have to keep in mind, I have been a fan of Van Vogt since age 12, and I've read everything he's written, and my own natural writing style also tends to copy some of his flamboyance, because he's my favorite author.
Mm-hmm.
So I am, of all men, the one most perfectly suited to write a Van Vogt-style book. I don't think anyone else can this sounds so much like bragging, I can't finish that. I will finish it for the sake of your listeners, though. I really don't think anyone else can impersonate his style as well as I can, because my whole life I've been a follower of his. I've been an admirer of his, of the way he tells a story. In one sense, I've been preparing my whole life for this book. In another sense, I hardly did any preparation at all.
Mm-hmm. No, I really do think that you definitely captured his style.
It sounds much better if someone else says it than me.
Yeah.
When I say it, that's terrible.
Yeah.
If someone else says it, it sounds like a very nice compliment, for which I thank you.
You know, another book that I thought about when I was reading this was Spider Robinson's Variable Star, and that was written off of a partial Heinlein outline. And I really liked that book, but I could definitely tell it wasn't quite as literal as you turn the page and you could tell, but it was, you could tell when Heinlein was fading out and Spider Robinson was kicking in.
I did enjoy some parts of Mr. Robinson's book because it did give me a nostalgic reminder of some of the Heinlein worlds that I visited in my youth. And some of the themes and ideas were clearly Heinleinian. Other things were very much Spider Robinson's sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
his political opinions, which I don't think matched the political opinions of Mr. Heinlein, his interest in things like jazz music and other things that didn't follow Mr. Heinlein's interests. So yeah, I think I could tell it was a Spider Robinson book and not a Robert Heinlein book.
Right.
And again, he wasn't trying to copy the Heinlein style. You can't copy anything too closely lest it lack all creativity. Except in my case where I was really trying to copy
exactly.
style very closely.
Now, is this project, do you think, going to be sort of a one-off thing for you?
Yes, it is, because I actually cannot financially afford to do something like this again. The reason I can't, I have to split the profits with which I'm happy to do, by the way, with Lydia Van Vogt. And I have other projects. In fact, what I'm working on now, I'm actually somewhat behind. I have some projects I have to catch up with and other of my own works I'd like to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, what other writers influenced you when you were growing up, or even beyond writers? What about movie makers?
Oh, you want to know who I steal my ideas from?
Sure.
I can probably list them. H.P. Lovecraft, Roger Zelazny, J.R.R. Tolkien, Tolstoy, to a degree, a little bit. He's not a science fiction writer. Van Vogt, certainly. Jack Vance, I impersonate. I love his use of language and his use of vocabulary. He's one of the most elegant writers I know. Gene Wolfe, I wish I could steal more from, because that man is an absolute genius. He's written things that have left me flabbergasted, have left me in awe of his craftsmanship, of his writing style. He's too smart for me, though, because I can never figure out what's really going on in his books, but I adore them nonetheless, as odd as that sounds. J.K. Chesterton is another writer I adore, though I came upon him rather late in my life.
Okay.
An obscure writer named William Hope Hodgson, who you may or may not have ever heard of, he wrote a book called The Nightlands.
Yeah, I have heard of him, yeah.
Which was an early kind of pre-Lovecraftian weird tale of the far future of Earth after the sun has been extinguished. And that captured my imagination in a dramatic way. I'm sure there's other writers I am forgetting that I should mention. Men I admire.
How about movie makers? Anybody, you know, a lot of writers I talk to nowadays are seemingly as much influenced by the movies as they were from actual literature.
Well, I kind of want to say Star Trek, only because the character of Mr. Spock is very near and dear to my heart. I have a great admiration for heartless people, and I have a great passion for dispassionate people. So I'm a big admirer of that character. And many of my characters reflect something of a concern for kind of Mr. Spockian logic from Star Trek. But I don't know, I don't think that I ever impersonate Gene Roddenberry's storytelling style or any of his themes, though I do admire his themes. He's, his philosophy and mine don't quite match. I can't think of anyone. I did think of another book writer, though, if you like. Mr. Olaf Stapledon.
Oh, yeah.
Fortunately, almost forgotten these days, but he was a giant in the early science fiction field, before there even was a science fiction field, in fact. He wrote a history of the entire futurity of the human race from now until its ultimate destruction after we colonized Neptune, and he wrote called Last and First Men. And my
right.
first novel, The Golden Age, was my update to Last and First Men by Olaf Stapledon. His imagination, even 100 years later, or however long it's been since he lived, is staggering. Just the depth of what he is able to invent, his sheer inventiveness is inspiring. My books tend not to be that visual. I wish they were more so. I wish they were more vivid and had more images in them, but I don't tend to think of them that way.
Interesting. So what other projects are you working on that we should keep an eye out for?
I hate to say it, but the manuscript I'm working on right now has been giving me so much difficulty that it has not even been finished yet, much less sold. It's called Count to a Trillion. It concerns a man whose wife has traveled to a distant globular cluster at M3, and the journey and the return journey is going to take some 67,000 years before she returns. The Lawrence Fitzgerald contraction will keep her young and healthy, of course, whereas he's got 67,000 years he has to wait. Fortunately, he's going to put himself into cold sleep, but he has to somehow, as patient as Odysseus trying to get home, find his way from era to era into the far future to meet his true love again, while everything he knows is swept away by the remorselessness of history. He also has a mission that he has to, with the technology that he remembers and preserves from the ancient high days from which he comes, to rebuild human society whenever it falls on its face, so that the technology level is high enough when she returns that they have a mechanism, they have a braking laser, to allow her ship to come to a halt.
Right.
What she is going to do is to try to plead with the intelligences that rule the Orion arm of the galaxy that humans be considered equal to other starfaring races. Those races that are not sufficiently advanced are treated as cattle or chattel. They're treated as slaves. So she's trying to free the human race from its enslavement. But the aliens have a very simple system for whether they judge a person to be a star-faring race or not, and that is whether or not they can maintain a culture, maintain their institutions, and keep their promises throughout the long distances that star travel requires. If you can't keep your promises for 67,000 years, you can't engage in trade and negotiation with someone who lives 39,000 light years away, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Paul's assuming it's slower than light travel. So the galactic empire that I'm envisioning for this book is a very slow, very cautious organism. And it's at war with the Andromeda galaxy, and Andromeda and the Milky Way are also caught up in a civil war throughout the Virgo supercluster. And the Virgo supercluster is also engaged in some competition with the Hercules supercluster and also regions as far away as the Corona Borealis supercluster, which is a billion light years away. So, in order to be a real, serious contender in the galactic and the cosmic scheme of things, the human race is going to have to learn how to make billion-year-long plans and carry them out. Otherwise, they'll be considered second-class citizens. That's what's going on behind it. That's the basic idea behind the plot. The idea is whether or not a man it will be sufficiently in love to do whatever it takes to find his true love again, no matter how far away she flees.
That sounds like a great setup, and I'm sure you'll be able to pull it off. If you can pull off Van Vogt, you can pull this one off.
I'm very grateful for your vote of confidence. You're more confident in my powers than I am.
There's one last question I wanted to ask you, and I don't want to put you on the spot about religion, but
sure.
You're famous, or maybe not so famous, for your transformation in your religious beliefs. I guess it's safe to say that you started out more or less as an atheist, and then...
Not more or less. I was a vituperative, evangelizing, hardcore atheist.
Okay.
My mission in life was to talk people out of what I regarded as an abominable superstition.
Okay. And so you came out essentially as a Christian, and recently you've sort of crystallized your belief and said that you are specifically selecting Catholicism.
Correct. Deceased, so, I joined the Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church.
Okay. My question is, do you find that it changes in any way the way you write or the kinds of things that you want to write about?
It's a very interesting question, and I don't know the answer because I write by inspiration rather than by calculation. But I'll ask you a question. Have you read any other books of mine aside from Null A Continuum?
I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't, but then again, there's only so many hours in the day.
Don't be embarrassed. I'm a mid-career writer. I'm not anything famous.
I did read some reviews of your, I think it was the Chaos novels. People were calling you to task for the sexual content, if I remember correctly.
there's a school girl who gets spanked by a rather aggressive headmaster, and apparently that's it's a little too outrageous for some people, and I think with some justice. I think the scene was tasteless, and in hindsight, maybe I shouldn't have written it. There's a good answer to your question. Now that I'm answerable to a higher power, I think I might not write as many schoolgirl spanking scenes in the future. you'll have to actually read the book to see what it was. When my editor and I both looked at it, none of us saw anything problematical about it. Upon rereading it, I could see why some people could read it and take it as being over the top. But at the time, and I was an atheist at the time, it didn't seem immoral to me. You know, it just seemed like normal naughtiness.
Right.
And not as outrageous as things that appear in young adult books, and not as you know, it seemed rather mild to me. But I think that my viewpoint is not necessarily completely objective. I mean, people, you can't tell your own work how it comes across. I've been waiting for someone who's read my books so that I could ask them if they could tell at what point I became a Christian, so that I could see if someone else could detect any difference in my writing. I don't use my writing as a soapbox. I don't use my writing as a advertisement for my own views. I'm not, if I may insult the great man, I'm not Robert Heinlein.
Right.
I'm not even Ayn Rand. I'm not trying to put across a viewpoint. I'm trying to tell a story. Now, if you undergo a conversion of your worldview, if you suddenly and dramatically change the way you think what reality itself is based on, and whether you think that the supernatural is legitimate and realistic, or if you think it is merely crazy superstition, your attitude to what is realistic and not realistic will be reflected in your writing, because you write according to the way you think. You can't escape it. A writer writes according to the way he thinks the world works, and if you change your mind as to how you think the world works, it's going to come across in the writing, whether you want it to or not. So I think that certain Christian themes and ideas will have to come across in my writing, whether I wish them to or not, but I also think that an honest writer is not going to write a thinly veiled advertisement for his own opinion unless he thinks the readers want to read that. Let me put it to you this way. I don't think Ayn Rand is dishonest for writing a book where she is very clearly and very strongly trying to hammer home her viewpoint in a completely unambiguous fashion. Okay?
Right.
No one who picks up an Ayn Rand book can possibly think she is not trying to sell her viewpoint. So she's completely honest. But if you pick up a book by Robert Heinlein, if I may once again insult an author much better than I am, he starts out like as if he's going to tell you a story about a Martian named Smith, and then inveigles his viewpoint into the work until it becomes quite obtrusive. Now, he's a very persuasive writer, and I regret to admit that he persuaded me when I was young to believe his kind of libertarian, semi-anarchist, free love philosophy. Because I was not wary enough to see both sides of the issue. And he's writing basically he's writing propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
In some of his other books, he doesn't do it. What's a good example? The Star Beast, in, Have Space That Will Travel, in, my favorite book, Citizen of the Galaxy. I don't think there's any overt propaganda toward some political viewpoint or toward the sexual revolution viewpoint or anything else that he's trying to put across in those books. In those books, he's just telling an honest story. But he, in some of his later books, segues into his kind of soapbox method.
Right. Yeah, I think, any writer.
I would avoid stepping onto a soapbox unless I warn the reader that that's exactly what they're for. Because some people, there are fans of C.S. Lewis, and he was writing clearly Christian allegory, and his readers want to read Christian allegory. They come to it for that. I don't think Lewis is being dishonest. On the other hand, J.R.R. Tolkien, who, if I may venture an opinion, is a superior writer to Mr. Lewis, was also writing a story that has some Christian themes in it, but you do not have to be Christian to appreciate his work. His work is magnificent, and it speaks to something more universal in human imagination, if you see what I'm saying.
Sure. Yeah, I think writers are more successful when they focus on storytelling and not on proselytizing.
I'm too wary to agree with that statement. I will say they have to select their audience. If a Christian writer wants to write for a Christian audience and wants to write Christian allegory, he will certainly please them. There are people for whom, and I'm one of them, that C.S. Lewis is among their favorite writers of all time. They adore the man. But I know of very few non-Christians who read Lewis with very much admiration because he's narrow to his audience. J.R.R. Tolkien, on the other hand, who was less preachy than Lewis, who was not trying to drive home a point, told a story that had more universal appeal. And I also know people who adore Tolkien, who worship him, you know, as a god, who memorize Elvish phrases and things like that, who know how to speak his made-up languages. And in fact, I'm one of those people. I'm a Tolkien nut. So I think it can go either way. I don't think a writer has to write his own philosophy in a book. I don't think he has to avoid it studiously. But I do think he has an obligation to warn the reader in the first chapter or with a warning label on the front if he's going to write something that's too obvious of an advertisement or something. If you're not going to just tell a story, if you're going to tell me your if you're going to preach a sermon to me, let me know beforehand, because if I'm going to hear a sermon, I want to make sure it's a sermon I'm going to like, if you see what I'm saying. The short answer is that I have so far not written anything that I intended to be a thinly disguised Christian allegory. I do hope someday soon to write thinly disguised Christian allegory, but for right now I'm just storytelling.
Thanks again for coming on to the podcast, and I wish you the best of luck with Null A Continuum and your future projects, and hopefully we can have you on again at some point in the future.
Thank you very much. It would certainly be my pleasure.
Okay, that was John C. Wright, author of Null A Continuum. You can read my review of Null A Continuum, as well as reviews of A.E. Van Vogt's 3 Null A novels at scifidimensions.com. I'll put links to these in the show notes. Now it's time for a couple of reminders. Don't forget you can pre-order copies of the new dark sci-fi anthology called Aberrant Dreams 1, The Awakening. The Awakening is due out in August from HD Image and will include a foreword by Jack McDevitt with stories from some of the most talented writers in the business, including Alistair Reynolds, Howard V. Hendricks, Ian Watson, Michael Bishop, and yours truly. To pre-order, visit hd-image.com/store. I'll put a link in the show notes. A reminder that I'll be a guest at this year's Dragon Con, August 29th through September 1st, right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Visit DragonCon.org for more information. 4-day memberships are $75 through July 15th. If you're picking this up through iTunes, please take a minute and post a customer review. Also, if you've enjoyed listening to the Sci-Fi Dimensions podcast, be sure to tell a friend. That's all for this time. Visit SciFiDimensions.com for the best in book, movie, TV, and comic reviews covering science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Email feedback to editor@scifidimensions.com. If you want, you can attach voicemail in MP3 or WAV format, and I'll try to play it in a future episode. Music by Brian Dorn at dorncreations.com. This is John Snyder saying thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.